these selections from two of John Cashin's conferences, conference number 2 on discernment, De Discretione, and conference number 17 concerning the making and keeping of promises, is an introduction to Cashin's understanding of what discernment, discretio, means. We've already looked at the notion of discernment in a number of authors, particularly we've seen in Antony's homily, an attempt to provide criteria by which an individual can judge whether an experience is from God or from the devil, rather not exactly crass, but rather general characteristics involving one's subjective response to those things. In general, if you'll recall, the notion was that which is full of tumult, that which is, and to use Evagrius' later categories, that which pushes you in the direction of anger is probably from the demonic, and that which bestows peace, which offers tranquility, which enables a person to genuinely deepen in a desire for God, that would be a reflection of something that comes from God. That's one aspect of, or one significant component to discernment that one finds in Athanasius and in Antony's actual genuine letters as well. And as we've seen, it's a part of Evagrius's understanding of discernment to some extent, although for him it's much more subtle. And the process of discernment involves a variety of activities, including a careful concentration on and awareness of one's thoughts, a prayerful asking of Christ of the meaning of these things, a dialogical relationship with the Lord that helps one uncover the deeper significance of them, as well as attention to those characteristics of one's own subjective response to the matter that's being tested or discerned. Here in Cashin, we find a specific notion of discernment that is exactly analogous to the ancient model of virtue. It's almost as if Cashin is saying that discernment is the same as trying to find the virtuous mean, the midpoint, avoiding extremes. And we'll see him using precisely these terms. But even more fundamental for him, as we'll see, is that discernment, discretio, in Cashin, has to do with not trying to solve the thing on your own. Real discernment, real searching out of the meaning of the thing, is something that has to be done in conversation with someone one trusts. So to use a kind of a modern analogy, in Roman Catholic communities, one can say in an almost skeptical sort of way that when one says, oh, he's off on discernment, what one often means is that individual has left the community context to be on their own to try to figure out what they're doing, and more often than not, the context of spiritual direction and of guidance has faded away. And so the tragic reality is that the modern kind of more skeptical appreciation of that is actually a perception of the deeper insight that discernment cannot be accomplished in isolation. If I'm truly going to discern, I have to involve myself with the judgment of others. I have to be willing to open my heart to others. And as we'll see, there's also in these conferences a reminder of the fact that what we see in the opening of the heart to one's spiritual father or mother really is also the beginnings of a deeper development in the sacrament of penance and reconciliation as we have it today. And it really is through the widespread practice of the kind of monastic spiritual guidance, which then becomes offered at the parochial, at the parish level as well, in the 5th and 6th centuries, that really results in a shift and a change that allows for the development, under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, of the former rite of expulsion and then readmission into the church, which is exclusively presided over by the bishop, to become something that can happen at the local level, that can happen at the parish level. We catch glimpses of that process, that shift taking place within these conferences. So let's take a look at chapter 2. He asks the question, what is the virtue or the observance that could enable a monk always to be unharmed by the snares and deceits of the devil? How can I discern? How can I understand whether something that lies before me, a choice or a possibility, comes from God or from the demons? And there's a description of of the classical virtues, the significance of things like solitude, reflection on the texts from the New Testament, particularly Jesus' admonitions, and a reflection not only on the solitude and secrecy, as he puts it, of the hermit life, but more importantly, the possibility of purity of heart. But as we drop down to number 2, 2, 3 and below into 2, 2, 4, what we find is a much more concise kind of definition in which he takes this allusion that he's had to the virtues that can happen when one is reflective in solitude and then points out that the real goal in discretio, in discernment, is passing by excess on either sides. One is to walk along what he puts it, what he calls the royal road, not suffering on the one hand from excess of zeal, fervoris excessu, or on the other hand, growing slack, becoming lukewarmness, tempore lentescere. So there is this desire to stand at the midpoint, not with excess, not with lukewarmness or growing slack or lazy, but what he calls due moderation. And it's precisely this discovery of due moderation which is what Aristotle says virtue consists in. So it's as if the ancient quest for virtue is being renamed, recast, being given the description of the quest for discretio and discernment. And insofar as they are almost the same, one can understand why this virtue is so highly prized. It is the constant ongoing effort to discover the midpoint. What is the excess or the apathy to which I'm being tempted, and how can I stay at that midpoint that will reveal to me most clearly what God wishes me to do? So it's not just a question of subjective response, it's a question of objectively assessing the directions in which the choice is leading and trying to avoid these two extremes. So he gives in chapter 5 of this same conference a description of one of the desert fathers who was deceived and who suffered in discernment precisely because he tried to do it on his own. Remember, he hinted at the beginning of the virtues of solitude. Now he's coming back and is going to say, one must not imagine that one can solve the most important questions alone. One must subject oneself to the wisdom of others. And so in chapter 10, in 2:10:1, Moses concludes, true discretion, vera discretio, can only be obtained by true humility. And the proof of this humility is, he says, reserving everything, not only what you do, but what you think, not only actions, but inward thoughts, to the scrutiny of the elders. So opening one's heart to a spiritual Abba or Amma who is skilled and competent is the path of discretion, is the path of discernment. Discernment is not achieved in isolation. It has to do with a manifestation of conscience, a willingness to open oneself and place one's reflections in the hand of the other. Now, we'll see that this does not necessarily entail absolute obedience to the judgment of the other. That would be the natural conclusion of this, and certainly if one's going to open one's heart to several wise and learned people, you're certainly going to take their advice very, very seriously. But as we'll see in Conference 17, there are limits to that, and sometimes pledges made, discernments accomplished, have to be reassessed and reevaluated at a later time. But we'll come to that in a bit. For now, the emphasis on what you can call the communal dimension of discernment. It is something that has to be done in relationship, in communion with at least one other. So, he says, it is for the scrutiny of the elder, and he says here, almost as if contradicting the point that we're going to make later, you must acquiesce in their decisions in all points. Well, we'll see. That's a very strict definition of obedience, which Cashin himself we'll have to modify a little later on. Someone cannot possibly be deceived, he says, who lives not by their own judgment, but according to the example of the elders. And he says, evil thoughts will hold sway in us. This is in 2:10:3, the yellow highlighted text. Evil thoughts will hold sway in us just as long as they are hidden in the heart. So here he's articulating a very modern and a very ancient insight that the difficulty in discerning what to do is very often caused precisely because we are not saying it in the presence of another. To articulate something in the presence of another human being allows one to see dimensions that are otherwise invisible. It's one of the aspects of spiritual direction. It certainly is the fundamental basis of psychotherapy. And here Cashin is pointing out that we will find that some things inside us are powerful only as long as we don't open our hearts, as we don't manifest them to another individual. And he gives an example of that in chapter 11, which story you're welcome to read. And then finally in 2.11.4, the confession, and it's not a what would seem to us to be a very great fault, he is told, the individual, the central person in the story, is told, without any words of mine, his spiritual father says, your confession frees you from slavery. After this exposure of him, the evil spirit will no longer be able to vex you because of your life-giving confession. Salutare confessione protractus. Your life-giving confession has had this wonderful effect of drawing out into the light from the darkness. And this is a kind of a vivid and visible apothem, a story that is intended to highlight Cashin's point that opening one's heart to an other, to a trusted other, is a fundamental and indispensable characteristic aspect of the process of discernment. And in 2.11.17, he points out that by no other fault does the devil drag a monk so precipitously and lead them to death as when this individual is persuaded to despise the counsel of the elders and rely on his own opinion and judgment. Ultimately, the individual's assessment is important, but the tendency to keep things to oneself, to want to keep secret or only have within the context of one's own heart the most important questions is a dangerous one in Cashin's model. And we can drop down really to the end of chapter 13 to number 2.13.12, where he says, everything should be disclosed to the elders and remedies for wounds be faithfully received from them, together with examples of life and conversation. Conversation really meaning here not so much verbal dialogue as a way of life. The notion of conversatio in this period and even later referred not only to interaction between human beings involving words, involving statements, but the sharing of a whole way of life. And here, again, is just basically a kind of a summary of exactly what we've said. Disclosing things to the elders enables one to discover from them the remedies for one's own wounds. He goes on in chapter 16, and we won't look at this in great detail, and the reason for skipping after it to number 26, he goes on to emphasize the role of discernment or discretion in what may seem to us to be a little bit odd, the virtue entailing what we eat, the avoidance of gluttony, trying to find balance in the diet. And this would be fundamental because it's something that one does all the time, does every day, and is, as it were, the beginning of those kinds of choices that we make about what we're going to do with our bodies. So there's a lot of discussion in the monastic literature and in Cashin as well, if you go to the original of these texts, on how you apply discretion, discernment, to the question of dietary intake. The next section consists of selections, and relatively brief ones, we won't be spending much time on this, from Conference 17, the Second Conference of Abba Joseph, on making promises. Now, the occasion of this conference is the fact that when Cashin and his friend Germanus left their monastery in Palestine to go to Egypt to undertake the visits to these various desert fathers, which allowed Cashin to record and later remember and perhaps, as it were, assemble together many of the things that have been said, as it were, recasting it decades later for the monks for whom he was writing in Gaul. The occasion of their being able to go to Egypt in the first place had been an experience of one of the desert fathers in Palestine, which encouraged them to want to go there. They wanted to see what had given this man his zeal and capacity for virtue, what had made him this tremendous example of virtuous monastic living. And they received permission from their superiors in Palestine to go, but on condition that they would remain there in Egypt temporarily and return within a specified period of time to Palestine. So, having discovered the wonders and the riches of Egyptian monasticism, now Cashan and Germanus are discovering they don't want to go back, or at least they don't want to go back at this time. They want to stay and discover the deeper truths. They want to profit their souls even more. Well, what about the fact that they've made a promise? In other words, what about the fact that they have already opened their hearts to their superiors, discovered in discernment the right to go to Egypt, and now they want to renegotiate that discernment contract without being able to speak to the individuals with whom they had originally made that agreement? And in many ways, it's a kind of an agonizing and studied discussion of, well, under what circumstances are you permitted to literally not fulfill the aspects of a promise that you've made? And this is a very dangerous area, of course, in moral theology. But Cashan's point is, sometimes it will be necessary, when it isn't possible to involve yourself again in a discernment with the original individuals with whom you made the promise, it will be necessary to assess in the sight of God according to the best lights you can, and it will be necessary to then make choices on that basis. And this is why I say that absolute obedience is not really the effect of this kind of opening of the heart. It is a profound respect for, a desire to act on that which one receives in the context of opening one's heart to the superior, but the actual carrying out of it may not be as simple as doing exactly what is said exactly as you said it. There may have to be adaptations and modifications depending on circumstances. And so if you drop down to number two, you'll find that he is recounting this issue. He's describing his own uncertainty and his own interior perplexity. And then in chapter five, you'll discover Abbot Germanus's explanation or reaction or response to them. Then finally in chapter eight, his recommendation that you really should not make absolute promises when that may involve a decision that can't be reversed without sin. So this is an opportunity to reflect, and it's in number 17.8.3, I've highlighted some text, that that it's best to avoid making promises that can't be fulfilled. But when you find yourself, he says, in a case where there is some serious loss and inconvenience, no matter what you do, whether you do what you promised to do or whether you do what you planned to do, then you have to assess which is the lesser of the evils that lies before you. The will, he says, should incline to that side which involves a loss that is more tolerable or that can more easily be made up for by the remedy of making amends, of explaining oneself afterwards. So even if you do stay a little longer in Egypt, you can at some point go back to Palestine, ask forgiveness, explain yourselves, and everything can be made right again. And in chapter 26, he says, "We never remember that venerable and approved fathers were hard and unyielding in their decisions, but as wax under the influence of heat, so they were modified by reason and when sounder counsels prevailed." To put it another way, the process of discernment may not be and often is not a single decision which then holds effect forever. That's not to say that one is not to be faithful to vows once made. That's a different matter and a matter of a much graver and higher obligation. If one is talking about, say, the marriage vow or a religious vow or the vows incumbent upon receiving the sacrament of holy orders. But short of those, if you will, profound obligations, one has to be able to adapt and adjust without being duplicitous about it. One has to realize that very many decisions in life, very many discernments entail a discovery of a direction which then must be assessed as one goes along. In other words, that discretion, that discernment, that opening of one's heart to counsel is an ongoing process. It's not a simple once made act, but something that continues over time. And that applies to most of the sort of what you might call second level issues in the area of discernment, and by that I mean again the ones that are not bound by a kind of absolute obligation which involves the absolute giving of oneself. Well, this is just a kind of a, if you will, an appendix, a kind of an addendum to the information in Conference 2 to enable us to realize that discernment is indeed an opening of one's heart to another. It is a process that is ongoing and may in fact involve an opening of one's heart later at subsequent times to another individual, if the one with whom the original discernment is not available. It is an ongoing action and may require some reassessment and readjustment in the discovery of God's will for one's life. And again, that almost in a certain sense seems to go without saying, but it's necessary to be aware of these principles, especially in light of the modern tendency to imagine the discernment is something that can be achieved in solitude by the individuals themselves without necessarily opening their heart to anyone.